And I'm going to share a very, very sad experience. There was a beautiful gal. In time she was about 11, she hit the streets, or 12, and she began drinking alcohol and doing all these things, as we don't have to get into that. And as a result, she'd been in a lot of trouble, in and out of adolescent units, and later she became a teenager. She'd been in juvenile jails, and she'd gotten so much trouble, her mother and father completely disowned her. And she was between about 22 and a half years of age. Now, how she got her money or made her living, that's her business. And she was in her automobile, and it was one of those kind with a fiberglass body that'll do 180 standing still. And she was out in one of them country roads with a lot of curves, and she was on alcohol and pills and needles and everything. She strung out, and she failed to negotiate a curve. And she hit a huge oak tree head on. And naturally, the fiberglass body of that sports car, it just went up like popcorn. She come right through the windshield, and the top of her skull hit the trunk of the tree and just crushed it like jelly. Well, after numerous brain surgeries, and in many, many days in intensive care, she lived. And it was a miracle there. And so they put her, and then they called her parents, and her parents told her, he said, what they could do and what they can't do with her. That they no longer knew her, that she was not theirs. Do with her whatever you want to. Well, she couldn't, so she couldn't stay in the, and so they moved her to the hospital. They didn't have any place to put her. So they went to the commissioner's court, and the commissioner's court and the county judge, they committed her to the state hospital for the mentally insane for the rest of her life, because she was totally paralyzed on one side and her memory was gone, period. She has no recollection whatsoever, didn't know who she was. She's basically a vegetable, but she was not on life support. And there she was, committed for the rest of her life. Now, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we ridicule professional people in the medical profession, psychiatrists, sometimes physicians. You know, if it hadn't been for them, they prescribed them pills and they did this and they did that. Well, we took them. We enjoyed them. And if we couldn't get them legitimately, we'd get it anyway. Drunks are the same way. And so there's this Cuban refugee psychiatrist somewhere along the line. He had worked with a lot of alcoholics, and he seemed to know about Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, knowing AA and knowing about AA are two different things. So he began to gather up all of her past medical history. And he began to suspicion that she was an alcoholic. And if this be the case, if she ever were going to get well, then she need not be with the people who were totally insane, because they couldn't give her the kind of medicine that Alcoholics Anonymous gives alcoholics. And that she needed to be over the alcohol recovery unit, to where she could get the finest medicine that us alcoholics get in AA, and that is love. So he went this way. After he confirmed his suspicions, he went to see the head of the alcohol recovery unit, explain what he would like to do with her, get her moved. They went back to the commissioner's court, they got her moved. And there she was, laying there with the drunks, totally paralyzed in the bed. And then when the lady members of AA that were sober would come in and hold AA meetings, they started falling in love with her and she with them. And they brought, she couldn't even remember how to wash her hair. And they shampooed her hair and brought her a hair dryer blower. She didn't even know how to use that. They taught her how to put lipstick on again and eye makeup. They bought her some designer jeans and some blouses. And she began to bloom like a beautiful flower. And then one day, one morning, they looked. There she was, out of the bed, dragging her old leg along the hall, going to meet. She never would say anything in the meetings. And then one day, she said, "My name is so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic." Love. God's love through people. Those gals just loved her into being. And she let them. Then the great day came to where she could go out on the weekend, provided she had two sober lady members of AA that came after her and took her back. And she went into the area, and she went to a lot of AA meetings, as many as they could in 2 days. And when they brought her back on Sunday night, the last thing she asked, she said, "Are you sure that if I ever get out of here, I can be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And he said, "Sure, doll." The day came to where she could leave, provided she had a place to live and she had two women AA sponsors. And she did. They had two gals, the same ones that had been kind of close to her, got her and found her a little efficiency apartment to live in, and she got a part-time job. She got a little job. She became self-supporting through her own contributions. She happened to be a member of this AA group that I'm a member of. And then the great night came when she was in one of those closed discussion meetings to where everybody in there is an expert about everything and don't know nothing about nothing. The topic for discussion that night at the meeting is, are you really sober if you're taking medication? Well, when it got around to her, she said, "You know, because of her massive brain damage, that she was subject to convulsions and seizures, that for the rest of her life she has to take Dilantin and phenobarbital." The minute she said phenobarbital, three members of AA, one sober 5 years, one sober going on 3 years, and one, they took every inch of hide off of that, yeah? They say, "You're not sober, you're taking dope." And not knowing any different, being that this was the only home that she had, no parents, no nothing. The only people who loved her and she loved them is more than anything in the world. And it happens to be a huge group with a paid secretary, and we have sobriety cards. So they can notify you when your birthday is, I guess. And so she goes in and asks for her sobriety card. And she tears it up. And she goes home and she flushes all of her prescribed medication, which she was not abusing, down the commode. 2 weeks later, she had a convulsion and a seizure, the kind that Gatorade and honey won't stop, salt water won't stop, honey and milk won't stop, and she died. One of her sponsors called me and said, "I just called her parents, and they said, that's the greatest news we have. No longer will anybody bother about it." I asked them what they wanted to do with her body, and they said, "It's yours, you keep it." Then she turned to me and she says, "David, what are we going to do about a funeral?" I said, "And a place for her in the cemetery." I said, "Don't worry about it. Our kind, we take care of our kind." And then she said, "What are we going to do about pallbearers?" And I said, "I know three." And coming back from the services at the cemetery, the one that was 5 years sober said to me, "Where did we go wrong?" And I just simply quoted word for word from our illustrated pamphlets on our traditions in Tradition 5 and said the AA group and its all of its dealings should be extra careful to emphasize that it is not invading the medical field. Through the personal experiences of its members, it's only qualified to carry only one message: how an alcoholic can recover in AA. That's all, period. Now, that is not an isolated case. It's happening all over AA world right now. Neither one of those three were epileptic. Neither one of those three had seizures. Neither one of those three were subject to convulsions. Neither one of those three had brain surgery that required that. As I said before, that in AA we're asked to share our experiences and not our opinions. Because our experience in Alcoholics Anonymous shows that opinions in many instances have a tendency to make sick people sicker and to physically kill people. It was their opinion that she was not sober. Now, in AA, we have a lot of doctors, but thank God we haven't got but one physician. I don't know about you, but, and you know, one of the best pamphlets to read on that is Medication and Other Drugs. I got kind of amused at the General Service Conference when that was going to be revised. God, of the 130-some-odd voting members, or the delegates, 90-some-odd delegates voting, all of a sudden, I'm listening to 85 pharmacologists. I'm meeting the 85 pharmacists. I'm listening to 85 chemists. They're all arguing about it. And they want to put trade names in like Valium. Well, you can't do that without getting there, the pharmaceutical house who manufactured, because it's a registered name and a registered trademark. And I'm listening to all this going on. And I'm looking around, and there's one, two, three physicians, none of them actively practicing, period. They were either teaching or retired. And I'm the only one in the conference that has a drug enforcement agency number to prescribe any kind of narcotics that's made, period. And I'm the only one. And it was utterly amazing how dumb I was and how smart they were. And they didn't know nothing. And so finally, they were really getting ready to get into a sling. And I just simply said, "Hey, wait a minute. Wait a minute. We've got a lot of people doing some things here that ain't got no business doing. Wait, we're bad enough, we're going to kill some more." And so they said, "Well, if you're so brilliant, you do it." And I was inherited to do it, not because it was done. There was four of us, really. Yeah, it's a tremendous piece. Now, I suggest you read it. Medication and Other Drugs. It's a revised pamphlet, because it clearly separates a lot of things and myths that we hear at Alcoholics Anonymous. It certainly does. Tradition 6. Each group. I'll tell you, when I get on to that 5 and I can still see that gal today, God, she was a great thing. They're just like telling them, give them a gun and tell them to guess which bullet is not in the chamber. You know? Yeah. Tradition 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. The related facility may be an outside group combating alcoholism, or an enterprise that AAs really want to start. And it was the latter enterprise that AAs wanted to start that often confronted the young fellowship. And you know, even today it still confronts our fellowship, especially with all the government money and the trust money and the tax-free money that is available today. Now, when the Hughes-Javits bill first came out about 16, 17 years ago, 18, you know, AAs all over the world, you know, and particularly in this country, were going into the drunk business. And you'd run into one of the members that were in the drunk business and say, "Say, I haven't seen you in an AA meeting. What are you doing these days?" Well, he'd be, you know, "Oh, David, I'm a seven." And I said, "Well, what's a seven?" "Oh, I'm working for the government. That's the government pay scale." I said, "You are? What are you doing?" "David, all my life, that's all I've ever wanted to be, is an alcoholism counselor." I said, "Well, you're only sober a year. Took you 23 years to admit you're an alcoholic, but all your life, that's all you've ever wanted to be, is an alcoholism counselor." Now, we lost a few of them, I'll tell you. And for their own protection, those in the treatment modalities had to start their own certification program, because there are a lot of drunks that thought that because they sponsored a few alcoholics and made a few 12-step calls, that qualified them to be, quote, an alcoholism counselor, you know. And so, as a result, they were leaving us. Now, in AA's early days, outside agencies were pretty scarce, and some members thought AA should cover the whole alcoholism front and field. And they had super promoters. They built all-purpose drying out joints, you know, and treatment. And as a result, they got into a lot of problems, some good, some bad, you know. They had a lot of ambitious centers. Some individual members have since founded some successful clubhouses, rest homes, halfway houses. We've got more halfway houses, three-quarter-inch houses, quarter-inch houses, half-inch houses, and then you can shake a stick at it, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. That's good. And therefore, it's been proven wise, by our own experience, to keep the operation of the facility separate from that of any AA group, and to keep the AA names, are like 12-step, 4-step, first step house out of the name. Now, towards outside agencies dealing with alcoholism, AA's policy is cooperation but not affiliation. A group cooperates, for example, by welcoming referrals from clinics or by sponsoring AA groups and institutions. AA members employed by outside agencies wear two hats, but Tradition 6 cautions such a member against wearing both hats at once. It's impossible for an alcoholic to wear two hats at the same time. It's real simple. They haven't got but one head. Now, on the job, he or she may be an alcoholism counselor, but there is no such thing as an AA counselor. There's no such thing as an AA counselor, AA lawyer, AA doctor, AA bum, AA housewife, AA bricklayer, AA bus driver. We haven't got but one kind of AA, and that's a member. That makes us all inclusive. And you know, we're all the same after we stop drinking. We're spiritually sick. Spiritually sick. We were all the same before we got here. We couldn't stay sober and we couldn't stay drunk. We can compare ourselves out the door by listening to the stories about get drunk and run through brick walls and shoot a battalion of Marines and all this kind of stuff and all that. Well, I must not be an alcoholic. I stayed home in my kimono and never got out of the bed. Well, you couldn't get out of the bed because you was drunk. And the one that shot the Marines that did it because he's drunk. And when in between drunks, he couldn't stay sober. That was a problem. stories vary, you know. But it's all the same, because the illness is the same. The recovery is the same. And so as a result, at meetings, they're just an AA member, not an alcoholism expert. And today we understand and accept the paradox. The more AA sticks to its primary purpose, the greater will be its helpful influence everywhere. Now, you know, we're all perfectionists. And after failing at perfection, we'd gone to the other extreme. We settled for the bottle and the blackout. Then Providence, through AA's, had brought us within sight and within reach of our highest expectation. So it became good reason with this kind of thinking, why shouldn't we share our way of life with everyone? Well, in the old days, they tried AA hospitals. They all folded, because you cannot put an AA group into business. Too many busybodies mess up the formula. If you've got 100 members of a group or 60 members, you've got 60 dictators. And no dictator likes to be dictated to. And I ain't seen a second-class dictator yet. And then when AA groups had their tried education, when they began to publicly drumbeat the merits of this brand or that brand, people became confused. They started asking questions: did AA fix drunks, or was it an educational project? Was AA spiritual, or was it religious? Was it medical? Was it a reform movement? Was it psychiatric? So in utter confusion and disgust, AA found itself married and getting married to all kinds of enterprises, some good and some bad. Then some AA groups started hounding legislators for legal reforms in this business of committing drunks to prisons and asylums. Now, then AA soon become mired in politics. So the experience then implanted a very deep-rooted conviction that in no circumstances could we endorse and any related enterprise, no matter how good. We of AA cannot be all things to all men, nor should we try. Then there was the AA member who thought about taking a job as a public relations job in one of the large distilling companies to educate the public about why alcoholics should not consume alcohol. Everybody knows why an alcoholic should not consume alcohol, except the alcoholic. In all of the advertising, he was to be described, you know, as the director of publicity and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there couldn't be the slightest objection if such an association hired the AA member solely because of his public relations ability and experience and its knowledge on alcoholism. But that was not the whole story. For in this particular member's case, not only was the AA member to break his anonymity at the public level, but he was also to link the name of AA to these particular education projects in the minds of millions. Now, just to show you what kind of head or mind this alcoholic had, now here I am, I've heard about AA, and I'm not sober. Okay. I turn on my television set, and here this monkey comes with his full face and his name. I'm a member of AA, and my name is so-and-so. I'm head of the publicity of this particular distillery. Now, the most popular selling brand on that distillery is Old Buzzard. My head says, David, that man is an admitted member of AA by his own admission, right before God and the public. He gives you his full name. He's also the director of publicity and education. That means that Alcoholics Anonymous endorses all the brands that that distillery distills. David, that means, David, that AA endorses you to drink Old Buzzard. And if you drink Old Buzzard, you ain't going to become no alcoholic. I guess I'm the only alcoholic in this meeting that's ever thought that way. You see? Now, after coming to his senses, now he really didn't come to his senses. He went and told the group. And the group said, "Hey, idiot, you wouldn't even have a suit of clothes on, money in your pocket, or a job if you wasn't sober. And AA is where you found a way to live sober. What do you want to do? Ruin us?" So the group threw the conscience to him, like they did with Bill, when Bill was going to work for Colonel Towns. The group said, "You're the head horse. If you do it, then people will follow. There won't be anybody here to talk to the drunks, and there won't be anybody to 12-step, to do 12-step work. And if you do it after you've been telling us not to, Bill, you're talking out two sides of your mouth," and it's the same thing with this particular member of AA. And because that member finally realized that AA saved his life and it had to come first. And he certainly did not want to be the guy to land AA in big time trouble, and this he would certainly do. And concerning endorsements, our friends said it all. "We was as never before, could we not lend the A name to any cause other than our own." Now, in cooperation with affiliation, substance abusers and AA meetings, unless this particular state or area is perfectly immune, this is one continuing, ongoing discussion and confusion. One recurring problem faced by AAs who carry the message into treatment facilities is the proliferation of non-alcoholic drug addicts in these facilities. Often the guidelines to attendance of these patients at AA meetings are unclear, which leads to complications on the part of AA members who carry the message. AA policy regarding non-alcoholic drug addicts is usually unknown to treatment facilities and committee members. And committee members find themselves in the position of having to educate professionals in this matter. Some treatment facilities are inclined to view all substance abusers and alcoholics as having the same common addictions, and are treated accordingly. Treatment facilities may have sufficient and valid reasons for employing these approaches during the treatment process. However, AAs who carry the message into treatment facilities often find that non-alcoholic addicts are encouraged by the facilities to attend AA meetings within the facility. In addition, because of the effectiveness of the AA program in providing post-treatment support to alcoholics, non-alcoholic drug addicts are often referred to AA when they leave treatment facilities. In such cases, the practices of a treatment facility is clearly at odds with AA's tradition. Now, you have to remember that our traditions are not treatment modalities traditions, but they are at odds with our traditions. AA's singleness of purpose must be communicated to the administrators and staff of treatment facilities by the treatment facilities committee or any interested member of AA. Again, the treatment facility committees have the task of informing and educating these professionals about AA policy and tradition. AA meetings within a treatment facility cannot be substance abuse meetings. They are held for alcoholics only, including duly addicted alcoholics. Although enlightening treatment facility personnel on the reasons for abiding by AA policy on this matter is often difficult and consuming, experience has shown that we are most effective. The most effective communication by AA is done in a loving manner and in a spirit of cooperation. Now, what I just got through going through is from the Treatment Facilities Workbook, page 83. It's our workbook and nobody else's. And you see, a lot of times, there's so much confusion about who we are and who we are not. And so now, from our own experiences, that the more AA minds its own business, the greater our general influence would become. Medicine, religion, and psychiatry has begun to bottom a bar, and they begin to use some of our ideas and experience. So has research, rehabilitation, and education. All sorts of therapeutic groups have begun to spring up. They deal with gambling, divorce, delinquency, dope addiction, mental illness, weight reduction, and the like. There's 150 some odd that are using that today. You know? They too borrowed from AA, but they made their own adaptation. They worked their own fields, and we did not have to endorse them nor tell them how to live. Our influence has not been just confined just to these fields. It is now very, very general in the world where we live. It crops out in political and business life. And people who know alcoholics and their families are very deeply affected. The very developments that AA wanted to force on other people, guess what? The minute we took our hands off of those things and stuck to our own business, we turned around and look at there. Education, educators are applauding us. Bankers are applauding us. We don't have to chase them. Because why? We're staying out of their business. We're not causing them any trouble individually and group-wide. And they like it. And they like it. Because you have to remember that from the outside world is where we get everything. Everything outside AA, is that's how they get to AA. You know? Yeah. Well, the hour is almost up, and I think what we'll do is we'll call a recess, and then, unless there's some other announcement to be made, because you've got two tremendous members of AA that are going to talk tonight, and y'all are more familiar with both of them. I happen to know both of them personally. I've known John a long time, a lot longer than Gay. But Gay is something else. She has to be, or this old crow sitting down on the front row ain't going to fool with her. And that quote, old crow, has known me from the sixth day that I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, that's right. That is correct. Sixth day. Thank you very, very much, and we'll see you then. I will see you in the morning. And then the rest of the fifth day is going. Do you have any announcements, Jimmy?
Hi, everybody. My name's David A., and I'm an alcoholic. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous am I sober this day, and for this I am so thankful. And I had several of you asked me how long I have been sober. Well, I am fat at necessary to, nor have I taken a drink of it, alcoholic nature, since April the 20th, 1967. However, my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous was last August, last Sunday in August of last year. It was over 40 years ago. I went drunk, started to fight drunk in the meeting, went out and drank some more and continued the fight, and they threw me out of the group, and they told me that they didn't need my kind there, and furthermore, I was too young to be an alcoholic. And I was real glad to hear that you didn't need me and I didn't need to be there. But I found out later that they knew more about me than I knew about myself at that time, because I was asked to come to that AA meeting, invited to come. It was an open meeting. And members of AA who could see in me what I could not possibly see in myself. But that was the turning point, basically, in my life. I didn't know that at that time, because they said something to me prior to that meeting, a few days prior to that, and that remained with me for all the remaining 17 years that I tried to kill myself and couldn't do it. And I found out, until God calls you home, you ain't going nowhere. You just might as well enjoy life and live real good. And AA does give our kind that way to live, if we so desire it. Well, we'll continue on numerically. Now we come to a tradition. There's no tradition in Alcoholics Anonymous that's taken a bigger beating than Tradition 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Now, let's face it, we have to be practical. A group can hardly hold its regular meeting on a street corner, and a coffee pot will not fill, an empty basket, rather, will not fill a coffee pot. But as soon as we become active in AA and in our group, we find out how many expenses are involved in making meetings effective. Then our horizons broaden. What about the intergroup or central office that many of us call to ask for help? And phone companies, you know, they do not give free service. God, the phone company is so thrilled, I am paying my bill. The phone company has given me a tremendous understanding. It's real simple, that as long as I pay my phone bill, the service will be on. And when I finish, if you refuse to pay for it, then they'll cut it off. That's simple. And just because we are blessed by God and this program doesn't mean that we can just go to them and say, hey, look at this work we're doing. Look at all these lives we're saving. Why, we are a boon to humankind. And the phone company said, that's real great, but we want our money. You have to remember that our traditions are nobody else's traditions. Nobody else's traditions. They're our traditions. And so as a result of that, beyond the locality, our own locality, we learn about AA General Service Office and the work that it does for groups everywhere. And AA activity is self-supporting, or ought to be, at all levels. And in every case, the responsibility comes right back to us as individual and collective members, because we are Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is ours, and it doesn't belong to anyone else, and it is our responsibility to enlarge our fellowship by inviting alcoholics in, if they so desire, to live the AA way of life. Now, sometimes when we're new, our contributions rattle rather than rustle. Now, you know, in very few groups today do they pass around, a pound coffee can, or a large one. they usually pass around bread baskets or something like that, or a hat. In the group I came in, I used to sit next to, he was reputed to be one of the wealthiest individuals, not only in the AA, but in the Southwest, and he was a multi-millionaire, and I used to sit next to him, and I'd put a dollar in the basket, and he'd reach into his pocket, and he'd pull out one of those old-fashioned snap purses that peddlers used to carry. And it was folded over, and he with rubber bands, he'd take the rubber bands off. Then it had three snaps. He'd undo the middle snap. That allowed the other side snaps to open up. And he'd open up the right side snap, and he'd run his hand in there, and he'd manipulate it like a puppy, and he'd pull out a quarter, and he'd put it in the basket. And I'd look at him, and I said, "You tight so-and-so," and I'd build up a resentment. And here I am, fresh, sober, you know, about 3 months, and just really supposedly loving AA and doing what I'm supposed to do. And every meeting I'd sit next to him, and I'd build up a resentment. It never occurred to me to move on the other side of the room and get away from him. And one particular Friday night, I was livid. I was absolutely livid because they had to have a new air conditioner or something, and so they appealed for a few more bucks, and he puts in that quarter. And I put in $2 that night. And I'll tell you what, I'm really hot. And after the meeting, my sponsor grabbed me, because this is the reason we look in each other's eyes and shake each other's hands. It tells us a lot about each other. My sponsor looked at me. He said, "What's wrong with you?" I said, "He's one of your business partners. That tight son of a gun, he puts in a quarter. And by God, I put in $2 tonight when they asked for increased funds." He looked at me and he said, "David, where did you get those $2 that you put in the basket?" I dropped my head and I said, "I wrote another hot check." He said, "AA doesn't need that kind of money, and AA doesn't want that kind of money. And furthermore, if you live to be 180 and stay sober all those times, and no matter how successful you'll be, you will never be able to help as many individuals in and out of AA that member is doing and has done anonymously." Yeah. And so, as a result, you know, and the first members of AA, they were in the same fix. They didn't have any money, you know, and they thought that a lot of money and outside help was needed. And then the modest sums and gifts that were coming in, and their plans called for, you know, required big-shot ideas of philanthropy. But as we talked about, John D. Rockefeller Jr., an early AA friend, said, "I'm afraid that money's going to spoil this thing." Now, a few AAs had already reached the same conclusion. Once again, gradually, the minority became the majority, as our experience has shown us, that our own members ourselves can provide enough to finance AA's proper aim, as long as we are informed the right reasons for it. In the simplest application, Tradition 7 is easily understood when we hear about an AA group being started with funds from a federal grant. And our quick response is, somebody goofed. Well, they certainly did. But then we come to the borderline cases, groups that put on a raffle for their benefit or for the central or intergroup offices and invite the non-member public to participate or buy tickets, and or have weekly bingo parties or semi-weekly parties and invite the general public to participate, and have dances and invite the general public to participate. Our hometown newspaper runs an ad in the paper for an AA dance or show, and the groups are not willing to pay for it. Now, these projects would be routine for any other society, but remember, we are not like any other society. We are very, very unique. True, such actions mean that we've got our hand out again asking non-members for money. Now, you know, their groups get into all kinds of troubles. And back when they used to have, and they'd get into clubhouses and they want to play for them. And they had one group that met, and the group in the clubhouse was the same, because after all, the clubhouse, in other words, it just skirted the spirit of the traditions. And sure, it was separately incorporated and et cetera, et cetera, but the group met there. But all the money that came in came from the group. And so, and this particular one was buying the literature. The group wasn't. The group didn't have its little treasure to buy its literature and do everything else. And so they were always running short that the group contributions wouldn't pay for the expenses. So they opened up an all 24-hour-a-day poker room on one of the rooms upstairs. And they would have volunteers from the group, and they would sit there and work shifts, and as each hand was completed, then whoever was, they'd cut the pot, and so much would go back downstairs to the treasure, and so much would go to whoever won the hand. Well, they had a problem, because they had one rule. And they didn't care who played up there, whether they're members or not, but they had one rule, that if you left the room, that your seat was vacant. Well, they always had those that were sweating the game, waiting for somebody to leave, and so they had another problem, that in order to go to the men's and the ladies' room, they had to leave the room because they didn't have any facility right there in the room. And they'd come back and their seat was taken. And so drunks aren't idiots. They made their own. They just opened up the windows, you know. Well, the neighbor's trees started dying, the grass started turning out, and the bushes were dying. And the neighbors got all upset. And so they just got, and they asked them to please not do that. And they say, this is AA. Well, anyway, one night they had a big crowd, and the neighbors called the police, and they raided them. And they took everybody in the poker room, and they went downstairs and even got the ones that were in the AA meeting. It had nothing to do with the gambling. Took them all down to jail. Then they got some lawyers in AA, you know, and they got a hold of the judge, and they say, "Say, look, they're harmless little penny-ante poker, and they're not bothering anybody, and they're staying sober, and what do you want them to do? Go be out on the street, and we promise you that if you'll let them go, they'll never do it again," you know? Well, and that's the way it was. And then one night, why, in that particular town, when it rains, the raindrops are half-dollar size. And they don't have any sewers in there, and everything just runs out towards the Gulf out there or somewhere in those canals. And they had one of them business meetings one night in that group, and this group was real conscious. And the house that they met in, the two-story house, was in a residential neighborhood. And it was right on the street corner. Well, if you go to a lot of AA meetings, it's just like this morning. I come in at 9:15, and maybe there's one or two sitting in the chairs, but 2 minutes before the meeting starts, everybody starts to come in. It's the same way with a group. And so that night, they had the business meeting, and there's something, whatever it was, and they all gathered. Well, They come at the last minute. There's no parking places, and so drunks, you know, they just park everywhere, and they parked on the neighbors' lawns and in their flower beds. And during this meeting, come one of them big rains, you know, that rains about an inch and a half in an hour. And when they got out, all their cars were stuck in the mud in the yards, and they had to call wreckers, and they tore. This was the straw that broke camel's back as far as the neighbors was concerned, and they got a lawsuit against them, and they said, "Move." And all this gets in the newspapers. Every doggone bit of it gets in the newspapers. Now, to go back to that group said they'd never do it again, well,
They had a state AA convention in that town, and they have about 1,800 or 2,000 or better come. And as you know, the Public Information Committee always gets it in the newspaper, you know, one column wide, and about how many members of AA are coming, and how many Al-Anons and Al-Ateens, and the usual stuff about the age, average age of its members, and how many members are male and how many members are female, and all this and all that, and how many chicken circuit riders they got coming from all over the world, you know, to make these stirring messages, you know, and all this and all that. Well, you know, Sunday morning, when everyone came for the last meeting, which in AA we call the spiritual meeting on Sunday morning, there on the front page of that newspaper, in the type the size of Japan bombs Pearl Harbor, were these words: Texas Rangers raid AA group for gambling. Now, let's all ask each other this question. Now, supposing that you have just come back from Las Vegas and you have drugged a family drunk black sheep back from Las Vegas. Now, that drunk has already hocked the grandma's ring and mama's ring with all the diamonds and the various stones for the colors of the years and the grandchildren, all of the jewelry, written a bunch of checks out there, been out there drunk for 3 months and gambling, and has just made a shambles of not only the life, but embarrassed everybody and everything. And you got him in the back room, and somebody says, what are you going to do with him? And someone says, well, why don't you call Alcoholics Anonymous? And right as you get ready to call Alcoholics Anonymous, there's always a nosy neighbor that knows everything about everybody in the neighborhood, comes running in and says, well, what are you going to do with that no-good drunk you got back there that's drunk? And they said, I'm getting ready to call Alcoholics Anonymous. And the neighbor said, now, wait a minute. And he shows them the front page of that newspaper about Texas Rangers raiding AA group for gambling. Would you call Alcoholics Anonymous for that drunk? The answer is rather obvious, isn't it? It's rather obvious, you know? And, you know, to talk about money... I received a phone call from one of our staff secretaries one of Wednesday afternoon, and God bless her, she's a good one. Cora Louise, she's no longer there, she's retired. And she was all excited. And she says, David, what about an AA group being dynamited out in West Texas? I said, Cora Louise, you're 3 years too late. This is the third time. And she says, well, what happened? Well, I didn't tell her this exact. I didn't have time. And what happened was there's some members got some resentments in the group they were in. And so they decided to start a new group. And they went out and they got this place. Now, drunks, when they start a new group, you know, they didn't buy 35 chairs and 2 tables. They bought 100 chairs, and they bought 10 tables, because they just knew that all of their AA babies were going to follow them, and God, and it's going to be something. And the 6 went out there and started this deal, and they had 3 meetings a week, and they'd sit there, and no new ones were coming. And at the end of 6 months, they were going broke. They were paying the rent and the utilities, and they were buying the coffee and literature, and nobody's coming. Nobody's coming. And their ego demanded that they keep that thing open. They don't care if it hair-lips the Pope. So they decided they needed to have more revenue. So they decided to play bingo on Saturday night. So they printed a bunch of flyers out and sent them around to the groups that they're going to play bingo after the Saturday night meeting in cash prizes. Well, the first Saturday night, my God, they had not only had every chair filled, they had all the tables sitting on everything, and they went out and bought some bingo cards and some beans. And, God, it was a success. And so they just went out and bought some more tables, some more chairs. Well, word got around that they're playing bingo at that deal, and they're giving away money. No lamps, no dogs or cats, you know, fluffy dolls or candy. They're giving away real money. And later on, truckers in their CBs were telling everybody about this thing, and they were inviting the neighbors that are non-alcoholics, no members of AA, you know, coming in there, and all the money was going to that bunch, and you know, and it got bigger, and then finally, it got so bad, the crowds were coming. The meeting was from 8 to 9. Bingo was supposed to start at 9:30. And so they'd start arriving at 8:45, and they would disrupt the meeting. So they moved the meeting time back to 7:30 to 8:30, and that didn't help. And so they just decided to knock off the Saturday night meeting. So that left them with two meetings a week. Well, the crowds got so big, and they found a one-legged drunk that just gotten out of the state insane asylum, and one of the group, well, a recovery unit in the state insane asylum, and they built a little room for him back there and with some bathroom facilities, and he was to look after the place and see that it was clean and be sure there's plenty of change and be sure of coffee and soft drinks and sort of that. And the prize has got to be up in four figures. And one morning he was hopping around on his one leg, and a long limousine drove up, and three well-dressed gentlemen came in, and they looked around, and they said, "Who's the boss here?" And he said, "Well, I'm sort of the manager." And they said, "You got a nice place here. Do you have insurance?" He said, "What do you mean?" "Well, do you have catastrophe insurance? You know, explosion, tornado." Old drunk looked at him. He said, "This is AA. God protects us." They said, "Is that your answer?" "Yes." 3 days later, the roof blew off. Well, drunks ain't no fools. One's good, two's better. So they not only fixed a roof, they added another room. Went, got some more tables, some more chairs, and by this time they went from the beans, they got one of those electronic boards, you know, to where you don't have to move from your seat. You can just see everything. And it got, and then they decided they were doing so well that they'd play bingo twice a week. And so it was doing so good on the second night, they just knocked off that middle meeting had been in the middle of the week, and they were down to one meeting a week. And God, they were running, and they had to go. They got two swampers to help that one-legged drunk. And by this time, that drunk, he's kind of, you know, taking a little, let's put it that. In other words, he's commingling of funds, as we used to say it, eh? And he's even got him a new false leg, you know. And God, they're just doing well. And that bunch that started that deal, they went from the old wore-out pickups, you know, and they got them, they're driving them fancy pickups, and they went from them inside-outside wore-out boots, and they've got them snake boots and iguano boots, and they've got chains, and they've got rings on. All this is for the good of AA, sure, you know. And so they're doing real well, and that old swamper, that old manager, he got three more visitors. They asked him, "Had they gotten insurance yet?" And he said, "No, that God protects them, it's AA." And he said, "That's your answer?" They said, "Yeah." Well, about a week later, the roof and the back wall blew off. Well, drunks are no fools. One's good, two's better, three's terrific. By this time, they were having so much money that the main prizes were being paid in five figures in cash. Well, they went out and they bought a piece of land. They laid a concrete slab floor, reinforced steel. that you could land one of those DC-10s on. They got them one of those Butler steel buildings and dropped the ceiling. They had room for 2,500 people. And they put in a full kitchen and a cafeteria. And they had them Atari games for the kids. And God, they were swimming in money, all in AA. But meantime, they were doing so well, they knocked off the Monday night meeting. And they were down to no meetings a week, but they were having a little discussion meeting in between bingo games. And meanwhile, the general public was just flooding the place. Well, the management got three more visitors. They asked them that same question. They got the same answer. But the next time that thing blew, it blew concrete slab floor, bingo balls, cards, chairs, tables, building all the way into New Mexico. Well, now, when you're using, someone uses explosives and dynamite, that interests a certain agency in the federal United States government that is absolutely the ugliest agency to do business with that you ever will, and I couldn't tell you this unless I experienced my own life, and that is the Secret Service. Or the Treasury Alcohol, they're the tea boys, alcohol, firearms, tobacco boys. And I'll tell you, if you think the FBI, and the farmer president, they're everywhere. They're just like gum on the heel of your shoe. And as a result of it, they got their attention. And it got into the newspapers. And when Cora Louise called me, she said, we have had reporters and mini cam operators from all of the television networks, including public television. And we've also had them from all the newspapers and the news wires and from the radio stations. And she says, my God. And they're asking these questions. What is AA doing involved in gambling? And I said, you called the wrong one. Why don't you call the delegate from out in that particular conference area? It's the third time, Cora Louise. Well, and that group got in so much trouble, so they decided, well, they'll knock off gambling and knock off bingo. And they went back just to being just a regular AA group. And guess what? About 14 months ago, that group had, quote, a business meeting. They call them group conscious meetings in today. A business meeting, and they voted to start playing bingo again. And so, you see, you win some, you lose some. It's the ones that get rained out, they're the toughest. Because, you see, it's not for recreation a lot of times. It's done to make up the shortfall. And as a result, it gets into trouble. Now, just to show you about how screwy drunks get to thinking about money, there was a member of AA, and he passed away. He was young in years comparatively. He was in his about 38, I guess. And he had been everywhere in this world to try to get sober and stay sober. And he came from a family that had a lot of money. And he'd been to Europe, and he'd been to all the fine treatment modalities, and he'd been to the high-dollar psychiatrist. And he passed away, but when he passed away, he was sober, and he was a member of AA. And his mother was so thrilled that when she passed away, she left a considerable sum of money to this Alcoholics Anonymous Incorporated of this town in the state of Texas. And it was a lot of money. It was in six figures. Well, there is no such thing
any place, anywhere. Many years ago, a lot of them tried to incorporate in states and in cities, and there's no such thing. So the trust department, when they probated the will, they wrote a letter to the central office in that town saying that they have this check made out to Alcoholics Anonymous Incorporated of that town in that state of Texas. And they wanted to know what would be the safest mailing address. And they told them how much money it was. And so they sent a cashier's check. And it was a lot of money. Well, it just so happens that in this particular central office, they had two that were working there as full-time paid employees, and both of them were members of AA, and they were married to each other. And they were mulling over this check when in walks a member of AA who is a lawyer. And they're explaining this dilemma to him that, hey, wait a minute, there's no such thing as incorporating AA in this town, in this county, in the state of Texas. The lawyer says, now, wait a minute. We have an entity law in the state of Texas. Now, I'll go over and I'll fill the papers out, and I'll go over to the courthouse, and I'll get my law partner to backdate him, and we'll form this entity in the state of Texas, and we'll enter it, and we'll have it notarized, and by God, we can cash that check. So they let him have it. And because those dollars were dancing in their eyes, and he ran over and he got it done. Then they give the lawyer the check, and he goes and has it cashed. He keeps one-third, and he gives them two-thirds, and then he disappears. And nobody has seen him since. It's been quite a few years ago. Whether he ended up in Mexico, nobody knows. But they have never seen him since. Well, the couple became a little bit scared about cashing that money. So they put it in a lockbox in the bank. Well, you never know, who's going to find out what's what. Well, when they probated the will and all of the remaining heirs and relatives, those who received money and those who didn't receive money, got a copy of the probated will. Well, one couple got it, and the wife read it, and she happened to be a member of Al-Anon. The husband, no, he was drinking of AA. And Al-Anon's traditions are like AA's traditions. And she said to him, if anybody was to get more money, it would be you. You're one of the legal heirs. They can't give money. AA does not accept money from non-alcoholics. They certainly don't. And in order to keep her from eating him out all the time and shutting up, he went down to the trust department of the bank. And he said, and he explained it. He heard, because he wasn't a member of AA, so they picked up the phone and they called our general service office and found out if there was such a thing as incorporated, and they said no. Well, they said, do y'all take money from non-alcoholics? And they said, no. Right now, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars of money that are held in escrow that AA cannot touch, but that has been given to AA by non-alcoholics in their wills, and they too have passed away, and so they have to go back through the legal machinery of the courts to get it back to the so-called rightful heirs if they are still alive. Well, the bank looked at this cash check, and so they called them up, and they instigated a lawsuit, and it went to trial. Well, the couple who hadn't cashed their check, they just returned the money. But the trust department wanted that other third, and they couldn't find that other third. And being that the other two had the money, even though they didn't spend it, even though they knew that there was not such a thing, they were implicated. It got into the courts, it got into the papers, and people started asking questions all about AA and the procedures of the trial and everything else got in there. And people, you see, and they even brought them into AA groups and hung them up on the bulletin boards. And it's just like, you know, you walk into a lot of AA groups, in particular that meet in the facility, and you look up there, and there's so-and-so's column, and there's something, this book about alcoholism, and they've got a picture of somebody's anonymity break, usually someone who's a well-known figure in the sports or in acting or in the arts or the crafts or whatever you want to call it, and they'll read it and they'll run out to buy their book, and you can't even have a big book meeting in the group because nobody wants to sit and come to it, you know. But that's good. That's the nature of our kind of people. We have got to suffer before we get here and many times after we get here to gear us back into the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of times, and pain is the great motivator in doing it. Pain is a great motivator in doing it. And folks, when the pain of sobriety gets greater than the pain when we were drinking, we'll go back to drinking. And there's no big mystery to that. That's AA's experience. And so, it's just that money, and I'll tell you, that's one of the reasons why the groups who just have their little meeting, they meet maybe once a week, and then they go to other AA group meetings from other groups. They're not involved with a facility over the long haul. Over the long haul. Unless the club type, legally club type, is policed properly with the proper trustees, but over the long haul. Those groups who don't get involved in leases and property and air conditioning and this and that and all this and all that, seem to work out pretty doggone good. They really do. They really do. Now, there's a reason for the club proliferation. You won't find very many clubs that AAs meet in states other than in through the South. Now, the reason is real simple. Because when AA came to the South, and I'll talk about only about Texas, and then if the shoe fits, wear it, and otherwise, don't worry about it. When they got there, the church is the Baptist, Southern Baptist Church. And as you well know, up until a few years ago, they didn't have any alcoholics in it. And they didn't want anybody meeting there in AA. So what did they do? And in a small town, they didn't have Catholic churches and our Episcopal churches. So, and most of the church is the church, you know. So they just got them a little abandoned store building. Later on, when they grew a little larger, they went out and bought them a little house out, maybe a little on the edge of town. And they'd put curtains in meetings. And then on Saturday night, they'd have one of those eating meetings, you know, to where they'd have home freezer ice cream and hot cobbler peach pie and fried chicken and every kind of bean salad and macaroni salad you can think of, and then they'd bake those cakes, you know,
And the kids that have a little sand pile in the back, and so they start calling it a club. And so another town wanted one. They thought that's the way AA is, so they started one, you know. And in the larger cities they were having, so they built more affluent ones, and that's the way it is, because you see, land was plentiful, vacant buildings were plentiful, the rent was cheap. But if you go into the highly populated areas in the East, they know they can't build one of them like you've got right here, something in here, right here in Atlanta. If they try to duplicate what you've got in one of them here, God, it's prohibitive. It would cost them $8 or $9 million to do that, because you don't buy land this way in New York City. You buy airspace. You betcha. You buy airspace. And so that's the reason for it, the precise reason. Same as in California and everywhere else. And it, you'll find the proliferation of it, though, if you'll go from Florida and you go right in into New Mexico, and the minute you get into Arizona and you get into California, and then go on up the West Coast, and then you'll find a few of them in the Middle West, but the rest of them, most of them are right along what we call the Confederate States, and then part of the states in the Southwest, the United States. And that's the precise reason for it. And people don't understand it. Because you've got one member of AA here that they started a very successful one in the state of Louisiana. And God, it used to be and still is, and it's a wonderful place. But they have been able to operate it over the period of years within, not only in the spirit of our tradition, but also in the guidelines that have evolved as AA has grown. As you see, you notice, you see guidelines. Guidelines are not conference action. And so there's been no conference action on the formation of clubs. But they pass. They have guidelines about how in the world they need to be set up so that they don't violate the commingling of the AA group. And this has to all do with money, folks. Every bit of it has to do with M-O-N-E-Y, money. And they've tried every way in the world to beat the spirit of it, but a lot of times it comes back to haunt them. And so, but often we do not have to ask. For AA is now very high on the worthy cause of our members. The General Service Office and groups, as I said before, politely turned down many unsolicited gifts and bequests from non-alcoholics, because in Tradition 7 there is a note of realism. Handsome gifts may have strings attached. The conference voted to put a limit of $1,000 of the amount that members may leave to AA in their wills when they pass away, and it has to be given to the in the year in which the will is probated, and it is non-perpetual. It's a one-day shot. Or that we can contribute annually like living. Now, you can give $100,000 to AA anytime you want to. All you do is get $100,000 $100,000 $1 bills and go to a lot of meetings. To a lot of meetings. And this is done so none of us can buy influence of our sobriety in AA, no matter how rich we are. Now, money may have a different problem. If a group treasurer grows too fat beyond a sensible reserve, well, you go in and you see some groups and you look at their financial statement, and they've got $12,000 in a CD in the bank drawing interest, and you say, well, I didn't know that groups could pile up that kind of money. Oh, that's for a building fund. Well, how long you been collecting for that building fund? Well, ever since the group got started. Well, how old is the group? 28 years, you know. Well, that's fine.